first off, I want to say when the book came out, I did hundreds and hundreds of radio interviews. And when Martin called me, there was only one interview that I remembered doing, and that was the one for Martin. He just really fell silent and allowed the spirit to be present for the interview. I just want to thank you. Okay. I was raised in what typically one might call a dysfunctional home. My mom left when I was 9, and I was raised by my father, who went off the deep end when my mother left. So it was just my sister and I. And I pretty much took over the duties of being mom. A lot of what my sister and I were exposed to at the time were things that I shut down and didn't remember. Then my father remarried, and that wasn't the greatest of all situations. A lot of what happened, I really just took in and dealt with and took in and dealt with and took in and dealt with and didn't really process. I didn't get counseling. There wasn't anything that I did about it except for experience it. I got married at 19 years old, and just right off the bat, it was just very unhealthy. And all I really want to say about that is that we're complete, and he's my best friend now, my ex-husband. All I have left for my parents, there isn't even forgiveness anymore because it's not required. There's just love and honor and gratitude. So everything I say, I want you to hear inside of that. So I had 2 little boys. They were 3 years apart, my oldest in the book. And if you have a book, please go to page 101 and change a typo because it changes context. And it says, Heavenly Father had a great white beard. It was a neat white beard. And it may not matter to you, but it matters to me. So in the book, it's Alex and Jacob. Their names are actually Ricky and Charlie. They are now 25 years old and 22 years old. Yeah, I'm 47, in case you're all wondering. And I do have grandkids. Ricky was in kindergarten at the time. And what I'd been dealing with were these periods of time where I would absolutely just not know myself. And I would do things that just were not a match for who I am and what I was committed to. And then I had memories resurfacing that I had no idea what to do with. Charlie was 3 years old. And there came a point, and I'd been doing this for about 2 years at the time, where it was about every 6 months I would just go into this cycle where I would just shut down completely. I would lock myself in the house. I wouldn't talk to people. I wouldn't answer the phone. Those kinds of things were unbearable. There came a point where I had a particular memory resurface that had me really have to face that one of my abusers knew what he was doing. And I had told myself for all these years that just chalked it up to he was drunk. He didn't know. And once that happened, something snapped for me. And I really felt like I was just not really there for my kids. The truth of the matter was I believed they were better off without me. So I went to the corner market to get milk. I was in my slippers. And it was about 11 o'clock at night. And I just didn't go home. I didn't call, nothing. And I went to a movie the next day. It was Flatliners, by the way. I don't even think I say in the book, but it was Flatliners, which is about this experiment around, you know, suicide and near-death experience and out-of-body experience. And I watched that film, and I went to the BX. We lived in Okinawa, Japan at the time. I bought shampoo, and I went and washed my hair in the bathroom at the BX. And I couldn't even tell you why I wasn't going home. I could not make this work. I could not figure it out. And I'm a prayerful person. Like, I just could not sort it out. So I finally went home, and I think it was about a day and a half later. I walk in through the door, and there's my husband at the time. His name's Richard. And my 2 children kneeling on the floor, and they're praying. And my husband gets up, and he's just white as a sheet. And he just says, where were you? And I didn't even know, like, what do you say? I went to get milk and I didn't come back. And then just the way my children were, they just didn't even know what to do with this. The next morning, my 6-year-old Ricky, he wouldn't even talk to me. He just curled up in a ball in the kitchen and just stayed there, just angry. And I did the whole day like this. And I just was really unwilling to mother like this ever again. So that night, it wasn't the first time I thought about it. Actually, I started contemplating suicide at 11 years old. but could never really work up the courage for something like that. And that night, I just really, there came a tipping point. I was not willing to live the life I was living anymore, and I couldn't see any other way. So I decided I'm going to slit my wrists. So what I did is I put on a white dress, and I went into the bathroom, and it must have been about 2 a.m. I broke apart a safety razor, and I'm looking in the mirror, at myself in the mirror, and I can see, and I don't talk about this in the book, but I could see somebody else in my eyes. And I really thought that I had multiple personality disorder, because there was clearly another presence in there. I just did it. I got in the tub, I laid down, I took that razor apart, and I took the blades and I dragged them across my wrists. And that's not an easy thing to do, actually. I'm in the tub, and I'm working on slicing my wrists. It's working and not really. And it's also terrifying. It's also scary. I'm bleeding, but not enough to really do the job. And by this point, it's like past the point of no return. Like, I really got to finish this, because now I've got this mess that I made on my wrists to deal with. So I open the medicine cabinet, and I take a prescription, and I swallow all of it. It's not very long before the room is spinning, and I go into my children's room, and I puke into an Easter basket, and I contemplate washing those things off and swallowing again, and choose instead to start taking everything in the medicine cabinet slowly, like all the liquids is what I started with. I just pretty much took everything in there, just slowly. And by about 4 a.m., I couldn't walk, and I laid down on the couch and wrote a note that just said to my husband that I was sorry, and to please tell my children I love them, to keep my wedding rings, and to my sister, Tony, to keep my earrings, my pearl earrings, and tell my children I love them. And so I lay there like that for a while, and I finally, it must be about 7 in the morning, I feel it really happening, and so my kids wake up, and I send them off to the neighbor with a note saying I'm sick. Will she watch him for the day? Then I lay down on the couch. It's like an airplane. We lived on an Air Force base, and I could have sworn there was an F-15 coming down in the backyard. There was this experience for me, like this vibration that was beyond anything I'd felt before. Like I was laying down in the belly of a plane, and there was this incredible, loud, whirring noise. And I thought that something was happening, you know, like a plane coming down, an earthquake, something like that. And I look around and realize that this experience is happening inside of me. And I can feel my spirit separating from my body. And so at that moment, I want to watch. I have a stepmom who had attempted suicide, she'd been in a car accident. And she had described an experience that she had, where she had watched herself while they were working on her in the emergency room, and she'd gone up to the corner of the room. And so I wanted to watch this happen. And so I opened my eyes, and as soon as I did, I could feel myself be sucked back into my body. And then I realized I had actually been out of my body. And as I close my eyes, I see this yellow membrane. It's illuminated, and there are these red lines running through it, like roadmap, you know, like highways. Like, I start to feel myself separate again. I open my eyes again to watch, and I feel myself be sucked back in my body. I did this a few times, and I finally just gave up and said, I really got that I'm going to have to will this. I have to really create this as well. It's not just going to happen, but there's an element of a choice in the matter. And so I close my eyes, and I succumb to the experience. And this yellow that I'm surrounded by, with these yellow lines, completely envelops me. And I can feel myself being squeezed like this. My arms are crossed. And at the same time, I'm feeling a contraction in my own abdomen, like I'm having a baby. And then I'm completely sucked into the experience then, and I'm pushed through this. And at the same time, I'm having this experience of just euphoria, like peace and joy and just excitement And in the next moment, I'm experiencing from more than one perspective at the same time. I'm looking at a baby like this, and I'm the baby looking at the woman like this. And she looks just like me, except for she's got really straight hair. And so I think that I'm one of my children looking at myself, and then I realize it's my mother. And my mom had left when I was 9, and I really believed, like really believed, she didn't love me and she didn't want me. And like in that moment, I'm experiencing her joy, just like the equivalent to the joy I felt when I brought my children in the world and the love. And I really got my mom loves me. And then she looks away. She's having a conversation with somebody in the room, and she just looks off to the side. And I don't care what they're talking about, and I have no idea what they're saying, and I am her, and she's me, and I just am so happy to be here. And it'd been a long time. Like, this was a foreign experience for me. It'd been so long since I felt like that. And then I moved right into every single moment of my life. And at this point, I start to realize, like, I'm viewing this on a screen before me. And at the same time, I am part of it. It's three-dimensional. I'm experiencing it from everybody's point of view, everybody's perspective. And I'm also this third-party, completely apathetic person that would be willing to leave two children motherless, right? All of it at the same time. Some of my memories when I came back, every memory was restored. But when I came back, I was only allowed to keep some of them. And one of them is of a birthday party. And I'm in this little red dress that I used to love to wear all the time. And I experienced the wrapping paper and like tearing that open and just the complete sheer joy of being alive. And just bouncing around the room. And it was all so real. Like, it was the perfect memory of it. And I'm experiencing it like it was the first time at the same time. And then I go through every single moment of my life. Every single moment. And I really get everybody's perspective. I really get like how everything I've ever done landed for somebody else, what that was like for them. And I really get like how it doesn't mean anything about me that my parents got a divorce and that they did what they did and they went through what they went through. And so I become aware that there's a presence next to me. There's a man, and I know that I know him, and I can't see him. And there's this feeling emanating from him. And it's just very simple. This is your life. This is the life you lived. That's all. And I come all the way to the end of my life where I am laying there on the couch. And it stops abruptly. I'm surrounded by darkness. Now, it's an absence of light, but there's another element to it as well. It's like it's like molecular darkness, like it has mass, and it has a voice, and it has power, and it can be used like a creative energy, like clay, to create. I'm surrounded by this, and I can see clearly even though there's no light. And I'm excited, like I'm ecstatic. I mean, I'm clear, I've realized at this point that I'm dead, and I'm proud of myself that I had done this. And I'm looking around for people that I know, like my uncle who had died when I was 11 and my cousin who had died when I was about 7 years old, I think. And they're not there. And I think, well, I would think that Lisa, my cousin, would at least be here because I know that she was a child and she was good and she was filled with love. Maybe Uncle Sid would be somewhere else because he didn't live such a stellar life, right? And so I swing my head to the right as I'm looking for them. And next to me is a line of teenagers. And there's about 6 of them. I lean over and look. And the girl on the right, she's about 16 years old. And she has this long, kind of just past shoulder length hair. And it's dishwater blonde. And it's really just stringy. But the thing I really notice about her is how dead she is. And it's more than a physical death. It's an indescribable death. Like, she's gone. And I think to myself, that's so sad. What in the world could a 16-year-old be dealing with that would have her take her life? Like, I'm aware that she's taken her life. Then I look at the kid next to me, and he's tall, and he's got this dark hair. It's obviously dyed black, and he's got black eyeliner, white t-shirt, a black leather vest, combat boots, like dark black jeans. And I think, wow, this is interesting that he has physical attributes when he's not in his body. And I'm having all these thoughts about this and about where we are. And he looks down at me when I think this. He looks down at me and then he looks away. And I realize my thoughts are audible, like he heard me. I say to myself, wow, we must be the suicides. And in that moment, I'm taken, standing upright like this, through this darkness, just at full speed. I couldn't tell you how far I traveled. I couldn't tell you how fast. I just know that it was incredibly fast, that I was somewhere on the earth. As I'm passing through this darkness, and there was no tunnel of light or anything for me, it was just surrounded by this darkness. As I'm passing through it, I ask a question in my mind as I'm landing on this plane that I can see. And the question is, where am I? What is this? And I hear the word purgatory. And I couldn't tell you why or anything about that. That's just what I heard. And as I look, I get just a brief split second of a glimpse. It's this beltway that's about 30 feet deep and extends, as I can see, to the left. And I'm told there are thousands of people here. And they're all in robes. And they're white, but they're dirty. And to my right are individuals coming down, dropping down just one at a time and filling up the space to the right. And as I land, I'm unaware. I'm not looking at myself, so I don't know what I had on. I had the experience that maybe I was in this black sweater that I wore a lot during that time. But I didn't look, so I couldn't tell you. And I also had the experience of not being entirely female anymore. Like, I was still me, but like maybe reproductive parts were missing. I look around and all these people are just talking to themselves, mumbling to themselves, very much like being at a party or in a movie theater where you can hear the din of people talking. They're not communicating to each other, none of them. They're all just talking about themselves, like what it was that they were stuck on in life. There was this one woman in particular. She had a beehive hairdo, and she was wailing. She was louder than some of the others, and she was just saying, if only you had listened to me, if only, like that. Okay? And that is just the gravity of the entire place. And then there's a man squatting next to me, and he's in a filthy white robe as well. I'm not seeing in color. I'm seeing in grayscale, and I know his eyes are blue, and I know he's been there for about 2,000 years. And I ask myself the question, I wonder if that's Judas Iscariot. He hears me, and I don't care that he hears me. And it, like with every moment that I'm there, I can feel this darkness sucking the life out of me, becoming me. And I can feel its presence just killing life and shutting down everything that we know as human beings that connects us. Love and contribution. And when I have this thought, I wonder if this is Judas Iscariot, all of a sudden I hear a voice, and it's out in the distance, but it's booming like the entire universe can hear it, but it's not loud. And this voice says, is this what you really want? And at the same time, I see a pinpoint of light, like a little star out in the distance, and it comes to me rapidly, like I would guess probably at the speed of light. And I realize I'm seeing the form of a man, and his hair is flowing, and his robes are flowing, and he's made of light. That he's got this rounded widow's peak, and he's beautiful to behold. I can't even describe the beauty, and I can hear slash feel all of the molecules around me, everything just vibrating. This is God, this is God, this is God, this is God. Like that.
And I'm surprised, I'm shocked, like, number one, that there's a God, and number two, that he's talking to me, and that I had, like, I had chosen it. You know, the question was, is this what you really want? And I just say, but my life is so hard. And he says, you think it's hard now. And he doesn't have to complete the sentence. I know what it is. It's like communication starts happening instantaneously. It doesn't compare to what happens if you take your life. And then he says, it's not your life to take. You can't skip over parts. It's supposed to be hard. We've all done it. I'm dumbstruck by all of this. Then I can, at the same time, I hear another voice. And I can't see anybody next to him. And they're out some distance from me. And I know they can't come in. And I know we can't leave. But there's no boundary that I can see. And I hear this other voice say, don't you understand? I did this for you. And in that moment, I start to see pinpricks of light inside the darkness, like he's behind something that I can't see through. And then I'm taken. And I don't understand how this happened, but this is what happened to me. I'm taken to a point of view where I can see God speaking with Christ. And I'm aware then that this is Christ. On the other side, I can see them from the other side, and they're having this conversation. And Christ is saying she doesn't get it. Their thoughts, this communication becomes instantaneous, like they're saying the same thing at the same time. And Christ communicates, like, my life, basically. And in that same moment, like, and I can also see the people in the bear in this beltway, and I can see myself standing there. And suddenly I'm inside Christ's body in the Garden of Gethsemane. And I'm experiencing Christ experiencing my life from the beginning to the end, just like I had, as if it was his own. And that happened just like this. Then I still was not willing to, I mean, I still just had the experience, like, I can't do this. There's no way. Like, I don't have any clue what is happening to me. I don't understand how to overcome this. And I certainly am not willing to put my kids through this anymore. And then all of a sudden I'm shown what would happen to my children without me. And first, it's like a roller coaster of their life, like the emotional experience of their life rather than, you know, the details. And I'm shown my oldest son, who's 6 at the time. He's 25 now. He came to a point to be about 21 years old. And he's standing there and I see him. And he's just filled with darkness, just like these teenagers that I was standing with. And just empty and rendered completely incapable of performing any of the purpose that he came here to perform. Out of having lost his mother, and in particular that way. And then I'm shown my younger son, Charlie's life. And he gets to be about 7, and then he's taken, and that's it, just because he can't actually do life without his mom. And so in that moment when I saw that, there's just like this little tiny okay that I just barely express, and then I am taken in that moment, just I'm out of there. And I look, and I'm actually above these people again, like, that are on the beltway. And I can see this darkness that's gathered there. And then around me are these entities, these spirits that are made of light. And they're flying past me so quickly that I can't even make out the details. And I ask the question, what is this? And I can still hear God speaking to me. And he says, well, we're in the final days and it's all happening right now. And they're helping you. They're assisting you. Then I'm just told millions of things. All these things, all these questions that I had about, you know, my marriage even and the state of it. And I'm shown that a marriage is an entity of itself and it's two parts. And one part happens to be male and the other part happens to be female. And that it's a whole unit together and that mine was really lopsided. But no judgment about it. Just that's just what's so. And I got how much my husband loved me in spite of everything that we were dealing with. It was as if I was just packed this suitcase of things that I'd need when I came back. And I just traveled through this darkness until I was back on the couch in my body. And I opened my eyes and I look around the room and my houseplants are made of light and I can see it like physical light, but not like these have like this glowing essence about them, but like concentrated light. And I can see light coming from the TV, even though it's not on. I can see the couch on a molecular level. I can see all of it vibrating together. We are couch serving you, serving God. The table, we are table serving you, serving God. Like I can see everything on this level of incredible gift. Like I'd never gotten life as a gift. I start to sit up and my husband's coming through the front door. And he works for NORAD at the time, okay, so it's kind of a big deal that he's coming through the front door in the middle of the day. That doesn't happen. He comes in the room and he sits down on the couch and he's white as a ghost as usual when these things are happening for me. I say, "You're never gonna believe this." And he says, "I think I just might." So I just tell him, you know, what happened. And I can just see, like, even though we're dealing with what we're dealing with, and these are things that most men are locked up in jail for, but I like what I can see is just the love. So then he asked me, "Do we need to take you to the hospital?" And I can still, like, for 3 days this went on where I could still hear God talking to me. And basically it's, "Don't go to the hospital. They'll put you in Hickam and it'll be a big deal and you won't be there for your family. And you've been brought to, back to life, restored to life by God. What more do you want?" And so, so I had to suffer through, you know, having the effects of the drugs in me. And I still have to deal with life just like I've always had to deal with it. But what is, you know, really isn't incredible. I have 8 children now, by the way. So my oldest boy, we came to a point when he was about 20 years old. I was not happy with the decisions he was making at the time. We had a kind of an explosion over something that I discovered at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and he's standing in my living room looking at me. And it's the boy that I saw, like that moment that I came to. And I heard God say, "Give him your coat also." And one of the decisions that he was making was to marry this girl that I didn't particularly like. You know, have you ever had that happen? So we got back in communication after a short falling out. And then this girl calls me a couple months later and out of the blue at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And she says, "I just read your book." And she just says, "I know that really happened." And they ended up getting married. And we have these amazing grandchildren, these 2 little boys that are incredible. And that girl and I have matching bathing suits, I want you to know. And she's my favorite person. Like, that's what we do when we get together, is we buy matching clothes. That's about it. And the other one is up to trouble right now, the 22-year-old, and he's just glad he's got his mom around. So, okay, so questions.
Before, when you were 27, you said that your husband and your children were praying, and you're a prayerful family. Were you affiliated with any religion?
We're LDS.
You're LDS, yeah. Okay.
I've been to a number of these meetings, read a number of books. I am trying to get my head around understanding if any time during that near-death experience it was communicated to you why you personally were selected to have this experience. Was it there a purpose expressed? I think I see it there, but was there a reason explained to you, or you came to an understanding why this was happening uniquely to you?
Do you understand? I got to come back?
Yes. Well, that's the second part. Why you were given the choice, but why were you selected when so many others, those 6 teenagers, for instance?
Okay. I got that.
I'm really inadequate in trying to express this. But
yeah. So there were times, actually, that I had the shotgun in my mouth with my toe on the trigger as well. And had I done that, there wouldn't have been the option. Like, I hadn't done anything to my body that wouldn't allow me to come back to my body, first of all. Second of all, like, what I know for myself is that I chose. And it took me a long time to see that each piece is like an expression. It's a, like, is this Judas Iscariot? For me, what that is that's an expression that I believe in a Jesus Christ as well. So that was the next piece. And so when I'm shown my children's lives and I say, okay, my body's still in a state that I can come back to it, and I chose. And as far as a near-death experience, everybody gets one of those. I just get two of them.
I'd like to know your personal experience in regards to, you said those teenagers that were in the dark side or something that committed suicide. I have a daughter who's 20, and she's had four of her friends commit suicide. So I'd like to figure out, because my daughter's also spent time in that thought. Of course, I'm concerned about that, and you've mentioned that you experienced that, and I'd like to know maybe the other side.
I got that. So first of all, don't do that. It's not a good idea. And second of all, if you've lost somebody to suicide, it's not the end either. That it's not a finite ending place. It's just kind of where you get the impact of what it is that done. And you're just gathered with people who are thinking like you're thinking is all it is. And it's not like final destiny. I'm clear about that. And pray for them. It makes all the difference.
In this, I just got to preface this question with this observation. In early Christian artworks, and George G. Ritchie talks about seeing angels preaching and helping the spirits in a hellish realm. And you see artworks that Christ, saints, and angels are there in hell, limbo, purgatory, rescuing souls out of there. My question is, did you see bright angels in hell rescuing the souls out of there in some cases?
What I saw was God and Christ talking to me. And what I actually saw from that point of view while I was there was God. And I saw all these other people talking to whatever, whoever, themselves, somebody else, not to each other. I suspect, and that's all I can speak to because I don't know the answer, but I suspect that they were also having communication. I don't know who they're talking to, but that is my own feeling about it, but it's just a feeling. And something else that I noticed too is the man that I was looking at, while I was having this conversation out there, he was like looking at me like, what are you doing? And looking out there like, who are you talking to? I got the feeling definitely he could not see what I could see. So my suspicion is that, yeah, that's what's happening.
Was there a lot of weeping and wailing and moaning and groaning that you heard when where you was at?
Yeah, I would characterize it as that. That's what I'd call that. Yeah, a lot of weeping and wailing. There was no gnashing of teeth where I was, though. It wasn't like that. But it was a lot of egocentric, which is not to say anything. I mean, I get it, you know, when you are in a space where you take your life. I get what you're dealing with. And it's also about the most, like, all-about-yourself thing you can do. I got that, too, about it. Like, that was something that I was told coming back is, this is the worst thing that you could have done.
What would be your advice to people that you know that have, like, for instance, myself, I have an ex-husband who committed suicide and blamed me. And I also have, you know, a daughter who has friends who's committed suicide. I have a very close neighbor whose daughter committed suicide, and they're of LDS background. So what kind of advice would you give as somebody like myself who would want to assist those who have dealt with loved ones who have committed suicide?
So three things. The first would be to pray so that you're enlisting, you know, the help that's out there. Second is to listen powerfully. Listen, listen, listen. And the third is actually, if you've look up Landmark Education, if you've ever heard of Landmark Education, it's a 3-day course, and I'm telling you, walk out of there after 3 days in an evening like you yourself have had a near-death experience. That's my recommendation.
So is there ever forgiveness? is there ever a way to put light back in the soul after having committed suicide?
My feeling is we're the ones that walk around in sackcloth and ashes, and that forgiveness is available like that, in that moment. That's my experience with forgiveness, not just in that moment. Like, it happened right then, forgiven right then, and I was still dead. We're the ones that are measuring time in a linear fashion, like it's the rotation of the planets. And actually, like, everything has a creation. Everything has a physical creation. It has a spiritual creation, which inhabits like the same approximate space. And then there's also a creation of light and darkness. A combination of that, more or less, a smile can actually alter that space. Things like trees that are just like standing in that same spot, just giving, that's all they do, are made of light. Their essence is light. They have a spirit, they have a physical form, and they have light. And then we measure things in this linear fashion, like the rotation of the planets, and we're the ones that put the time frame on it. All things actually are entities in themselves, all experiences, all every moment. So it looks to us like an ordering. This is how God knows the future is actually, it's happened already. It's already has his expression. It's just, you are on page 64 of this book that you're writing called Your Life, and it's already done. Forgiveness is like that.
When you were in that place and those teenagers were lined up alongside of you, is there any way we can get our teenagers there for... No, that's not my question. I was impressed when you said, when you came back and you said, the table is here for you and the table is here for God and this is here for you and it's here for God. Like, they are living things, living entities that are there to serve you as well as God. Could you expand on that a little bit? I've had some strange feelings.
Okay.
I don't know why.
Okay.
But when I'm working on the basement or something and... a drill the other day got in my way and I kicked it off to the side, and the thought went through my mind, what are you taking it out on that drill for? It just got through serving you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, What the hell are you thinking about that for?
Yeah, well, thank goodness it doesn't have nerve endings, right? Yeah, it's like serving God by virtue of serving you by virtue of serving God. It's all one thing. But like, you know, it's service for you is the whole thing. And so what serves you would be a question you could ask yourself. If it does something for you, if it rocks your world to apologize to the drill, then apologize to that drill.
Just a quick question, Angie. Did you feel that religion had any significance in that place?
I'm LDS, as I've said, and on the way back, I was actually quoted some scriptures that came from the Doctrine and Covenants, one being, it's out of small things that great things come to pass, which struck me as odd, but I did not have, so it was both. It's actually yes to both of those. My religion was supported inside of this near-death experience, and I would never tell you that my experience invalidates your religion. Like, I really am clear that God answers by any name that we call him, and I do not know any more than you do.
Do you remember which pathway your spirit leave your body? From your head, from your mouth, from your nose? Which pathway? I know the spirit comes to human body through the head.
Okay.
Especially the baby was born. And okay. That's the moment spirit goes into the body.
Okay.
So when spirit comes out, which
so
way?
For me, what happened is that I was trying to watch, and I have no idea. What kept happening for me was just transition, completely transition from in my body, laying there in my body, eyes open on the couch, close my eyes, and I'm in my own birth. I'm experiencing my first memory, which is of being born. That's how it went for me.
I was just wondering, when you came back, how easy was that transition back to a normal life?
Back to a normal life.
Or quote-unquote normal life.
What do you mean by that?
With your family and friends, and were you just happy to be there? And
this happened in 91, and so there wasn't a lot out there about near-death experience at the time, for one thing. Like, there was no support for it. So I didn't have anybody to talk to about it, really, and I wasn't even clear what had happened to me. I knew what happened was real. That's what I knew. There were certain things that changed dramatically, and that is, like, the type of music I listened to. Like, I could totally see light and darkness. I still can. Like, I can hear it. I can see it. Yeah, like, on a deeper level than just visually. Like, we can all see it. You guys can all see it. You know, when you're standing there with a murderer, everybody talks about that experience of being in that presence. Like, for me, it's a little deeper. It's like I can see the particles, the darkness or the light. I can see it in particle form, and that increases sometimes dramatically, just depending on how present I am, and sometimes it decreases. But I never went back to celebrating darkness ever, or like, this is the end of the world. I mean, I went through some pretty traumatic things after that experience over the years. I've never dealt with them like, this is the end. Ugh, no. Like, so that traumatically was just completely different. But I still deal with life, so.
You had mentioned, and I believe it was before you had slit your wrists, that there was a presence that you actually saw in your own eyes. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if you could speak to that.
What do you want to know about that?
I assumed you meant it was a presence other than what you felt was your own self.
Mm-hmm. I don't really know how to describe it except for, like, there was just another person, another entity of some kind with its own purpose and thoughts and feelings and of darkness. It was of darkness.
I was just wondering, the beings of light that came down on the right side, what were they doing as they came down one by one?
So the beltway where I was landing, they were like me. The ones coming down into the space, they were just like me. Like, they had committed suicide too. And when I left, then I was like, it was like this layer, like vinegar and oil, like this layer of darkness with all of us that I could see. I didn't see any other people gathered there, just us. And then this layer above that wasn't necessarily light, there was still the surrounding darkness, but it was benign, okay? And the spirits whipping past me had a fine molecular structure, so I could see through them, and they were fast, like, I could hardly make out any detail at all.
I lost a son to suicide 7 years ago. I have spent the time since researching and trying to validate that progress continues on the other side. Would you talk about your feelings about that and whether that would go along with, you know, your experience? And because I truly believe it. I really believe it, that progress continues.
Yeah, it does. I know that it does. I invite you to stay and talk to me afterwards, too.
When you were there, when in the darkness, did those entities ever try to influence you to continue to stay there and be with them, the dark force, to continue a path of unrighteousness and like that?
I don't know what the people, basically, that I was with there were so self-consumed that they didn't care what was going on with anybody but themselves. But the darkness there did. It was like this electric, gravitational, like a tide that you can't, like if you've ever been caught in a riptide like that, only multiply that a million times.
Since you had your experience, have you had any thoughts regarding people who have legally been permitted to commit suicide?
What had me write the book was, I was in, like I said, I was in Okinawa, Japan at the time. When I came back to the States, we were really isolated over there. We got Oprah once a week, I think, and maybe CNN. It was mostly Dragon Ball Z, okay, is what we got in Japanese that I watched on TV. And when I came back to the States, I was overwhelmed by just the level of near-death experience in the news, on the shows. Betty Eady's book, Embraced by the Light, was the number one bestseller at the time and had been for 6 months. Dateline ran something, the popsicles are in bloom, where they put the LCD message on the top of cabinets in a crash room and an ER, and then they'd interview patients that had flatlined later and ask them, did you see what it said? And they'd change the message daily. So this was in the news a lot. And there was this 1 week's period of time. The first thing that happened was that Kurt Cobain killed himself. And he's, if you don't know, he was the lead vocalist for Nirvana. And I lived in Seattle area at the time, and I was a fan. I was in town. I lived up in the Cascades. It was a half an hour drive to town, and I was in town shopping that day for my weekly shopping trip. And as it was one of the very few beautiful, lovely, sunny days in Seattle, and I had my window rolled down, and I'm listening to the radio at the same time as a van load of teenagers drives past me, and I'm hearing the announcer say that they found Kurt Cobain's body, that he'd blown his head off with a shotgun. And this vanload of teenagers is driving past me, and they're all hanging out the windows saying, my hero's dead. And I knew there would be kids who were going to do the same thing because he did. And then the second thing that happened was I saw Thelma and Louise on TV. I couldn't explain why, but it was just as if somebody very close to me had died. They drive off a cliff at the end, you know, of their spree. And I went upstairs and I locked myself in my room and I sobbed for 2 hours thinking, that's really weird. And then I saw a news story and Dr. Kevorkian was on trial. I knew somebody, there's all this near-death experience out there and everybody's talking about these tunnels of light and nobody's talking about what happens if you take your life. And I knew somebody needed to do that. And so I got on my knees and I just said a prayer, what can I do? And I heard a voice, and now I recognize, you know, when you hear a voice sometimes when you're praying, now I recognize that's God. I mean, I recognize his voice as if, you know, it's my, I have, you know, elements to my voice, characteristics to my voice. He has characteristics to his voice. I recognize his voice. And he said, you could write a book. And I said, oh, I could. And the next day, I opened the phone book. Betty Eady's number is actually still in the phone book of all things, and she's from there. And I call the number, and they've transferred it to a literary agency, and her son has just opened this agency. I call, and they say, we've been waiting for you to call. Within 3 days off of my journal entry, he had the book sold to Bantam. So my answer is, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't recommend it. I feel like there are definitely things, there's purpose to everything, everything. There isn't anything that you can't do powerfully, including go through the end of your life, even if it's an extended thing that you have to deal with.
You said the experiences with your mom and dad, and you didn't feel loved by them and with your husband, but then you were able to feel the love that your mother had with you. How'd you get to the point that there's your past forgiveness, you're into pure love with them when there was such pain?
There's something about being in somebody else's shoes that transforms your experience of life. When you get to experience what somebody else was dealing with, it changes everything. So my mom, actually, when she left, she joined a cult. A lot of what I experienced as a kid was through that, and there was a lot of abuse that went on, and I really came to a point where I could see as if I was my mother. If I had all of her DNA, if I had her parents, and I had every experience that she had, I had every interpretation of those experiences that she had, if I had all of that as if I was her, I might have done the same thing. I'm very clear my mom did what she did because she loved me.
But what about your dad?
Same thing. Same thing. I can get that about anybody in my life. No joke.
So life is tough. You commit suicide. You see the dark side. It's not worth it. You come back. What are the strategies you use to deal with the toughness in life?
I wouldn't call it strategy, because strategy kind of indicates that there's an enemy. I don't view life as the problem that I have to deal with anymore, because that is definitely how I viewed life, was this is something to overcome. This is something to get through. This is something to survive. What I have is just one incredible moment after another incredible moment. No matter what's going on, I really can just choose who I'm going to be. So there, that would be it. Choose. Choose life. Choose every moment. Surrender to every piece of it.
Among the commonalities that people experience with the near-death experiences, I've struck by the one, the communication on the other side is instantaneous. Did you retain any of that ability as you came here? And if so, do you recognize that there are other people that have retained that ability?
It's a skill that can actually be developed. And I do know people, yeah, that develop themselves in listening. It's listening. It's just a very keen listening, like beyond a physical listening. And then some people are gifted with it as well, but it can also be developed. And what was the first part of your question? Did I bring that back with me? To a degree, to a small degree, and then since then I've actually developed that more.
Since your experience, how often have you experienced flashbacks or like moments that something might have triggered the experience again and you've gotten maybe lessons and things like that?
First of all, like the experience itself is solid for me around memory. Like I remember the experience now 20 years later better than I remember having breakfast this morning, better than I remember driving here, better than I remember sitting in that chair 20 minutes ago or however long it was ago. It lives for me like present now. And then what was the other part of your question?
Well, I was wondering if like you'd be going along in your life and then something would trigger you back to that memory or that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Especially when things show up that I didn't get, I was being foretold something. And then it happens, like my son standing there in the living room, and it's like I'm in that moment, you know, choose, and he can go this way, he can go that way, and I have power there to make a difference. Definitely those. There are other moments where I've been taken back to points where I can see at the level that I could see when I came back of light and darkness, and just every time I even tell about it, actually.
So before you come back, were you shown that you were going to have more kids if you did come back? Mm-mm. Were you told that?
No, but I was getting ready to have my tubes tied a couple of years later. Yeah, I'm telling you, those two boys, what one didn't think of, the other did. I was done having kids, and I was just told, don't do that, there's more. Then I got pregnant with my 15-year-old. He's 7 years younger than Charlie. And one time I'm standing in the backyard, and this was a couple years before I conceived, and I was digging up St. John's wort that was going crazy in the yard and moving it. I was on a third of an acre, and I felt somebody looking at me. And I look up, and I see a little boy standing there. He's in this striped shirt, and he's got this bowl cut that I tortured my children with, by the way. They tell me now that's not the haircut. But his hair's brown. My two older boys are blonde. But there's this really strong family resemblance. And he's about 8. And there's just this feeling coming from him, like deep sadness, like melancholy. I know that I'm seeing some kind of a spirit. I'm seeing him in color, like solid form, though. And so I put down my shovel because I'm terrified I'm going to dig up somebody's bones in my yard. So I lay the shovel down and I look up and he's gone. And then I conceived him. Then I had this boy a couple years later. It was just before he was born, I think, about a week. The power went out in the middle of the night, and Richard went down the stairs to flip the switches in the fuse box. And he comes back upstairs and he says, well, that was interesting. He said, when he got downstairs, there's a little boy sitting on the couch, and he's about 8 years old, little brown bowl cut. He's in his underwear, though. And he's sitting here like this with his elbow resting on the couch. We'd already named him. And so he says, well, hey, Sam. Like the boy didn't respond, but he says that he just got this feeling of melancholy, like deep sadness. And then my mother-in-law came to visit after I had him, and I was telling her about this, and she goes, well, that's interesting. I was staying in my sister's attic one night, and I get woke up in the night, and there's this little boy standing next to the bed, same description, and just the same thing, just this sadness, not a word, just this sadness. And we all know it was Sam, and we still don't know why he was sad. He's fine now. He's happy now.
So did you stay with your husband then?
Nope, we were divorced, yeah. powerfully so, I should say. Like, he's my best friend. He's my partner in raising these kids. But the marriage did not work inside of what was happening. And those things weren't changing.
Are you comfortable talking about the marriage?
Yeah, to a degree. He's not here to defend himself. In all fairness, I wouldn't want to, you know, share anything that he wouldn't stand up here and share himself.
I've been trying to think about a question to ask you, but maybe you can give me your feedback.
Okay.
Because these people that are checking out, mm-hmm. and doing this dastardly deed to themselves are all connected to somebody here that's living. So in my mind, it's a cry for help, and we're not listening. We people that are still here are not listening. And I get these experiences, like, just to sum this up quickly, I had a feeling to call my dad about 4 days before Father's Day, and I didn't listen. And so when I called my dad on Father's Day, I'd learned that he had a stroke and he couldn't talk. And so I beat myself up for not taking that opportunity when I could have talked with him when I got that feeling. So I'm sure a lot of us have a feeling and we don't act on it because we're not in tune. And I just wonder what your feedback is when you've been on the other side. What's going on there for these people? They're crying out for help, are they not? And saying, hey, if somebody only would have been there for me or paid attention or called me up. Because I had an experience one day when someone shared this with me, that they went to the mall and they just had a feeling to go up to this person and say, hi, my name's so-and-so, and I'm glad you're here. And the person looked at him and just started to weep because that person was looking around thinking of committing suicide and this would have been their last day. But somebody cared and they didn't even know who that was. And so I think about that. What's your feedback on that? Thank you.
Yeah, definitely be courageous in life. You just never know. I definitely have given up ever what anybody might think about me for saying something or asking a question. But I would also include with that, do not beat yourself up either. And I know that's kind of impossible. We tend to do that, don't we, as human beings? But here's what happens when you experience yourself like, I screwed this up. I could have made a difference and I didn't because I didn't listen. Is you actually are no longer present anymore that you can hear. You're like up here in your head. I did this thing. You're with your own thoughts and you're actually not listening. So that would be definitely just really forgive yourself.
When you saw the other kids with you that had committed suicide and you knew you were there because you'd committed suicide, could you see how they had died? Like, could you see one had shot himself or one had overdosed? Or did you know the reasons how they'd gotten there? Could you see your wrists slashed?
I didn't care in that moment. I probably could have if I'd have asked. I didn't care. I was one of them. I was just wrapped up in myself. And like, poor me, you know? And I didn't look at my wrist. I didn't look at myself. So I couldn't tell you.
I have a daughter who committed suicide, and she tells me that the darkness is composed of negative thought patterns, of guilt and fear, and nothing more. She also tells me that it's a labyrinth of confusion that you enter into, and that it's very temporary. There's no condemnation. There's no going to hell. There's no suffering other than the suffering that you allow yourself to have. And I just wanted your feelings about that.
That would be my description, too. Like, that's what I would say, too.
You just made a comment, and you said that you were with your or somebody was with their thoughts, and they couldn't be receptive to the promptings, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Would you elaborate on that? What do you do now that's different from what you did before?
What am I doing now? I dismantle those things when they come up. Is what I do. You know, I still do that. I still get lost in my experiences of myself as a failure, you know, if only I'd done this or done that. But I dismantle those conversations that are happening really here. I mean, really, just listen. You've got a voice running the show right now, and it's telling, you know, making all kinds of judgments and assessments, right? Yeah.
So you just stop thinking.
It's always
thinking
there.
That.
Yeah, I stop listening. I just tell it to shut up.
So shut up, and then what do you do?
And then I act.
Oh, okay.
I listen and I act.
Sort of like pray?
And I pray. That would be a form of action inside of that, okay. Definitely.
I was reading the paper that you handed out, and you said that every single thing is an action or
every single, including depression, is a matter of choice. I don't think you probably thought that before, so you're saying now you don't think that if we're depressed that it can be just a matter of, okay, I'm not going to be depressed anymore, or?
All things are choice.
You think
you just don't know it. It's like, what's the difference between somebody who has everything that they need in place to make a choice, somebody who knows, and then somebody who doesn't? There's no difference. Everything is definitely choice. We just don't always know that there's choice.
Did you choose to get married again? Did you remarry?
I did. I remarried a widower who had 3 children. He and I were divorced 5 years later, and his kids stayed with me, which is how I got 8.
You indicated that life is like a book, and we are on like page 64, and there are many more, which suggests that things are scripted and maybe predetermined. On the other hand, you say we have a choice in everything. So how do you reconcile those two?
Okay, you're on page 64, but you're writing the book. And God is omniscient, and he's not stuck on page 64. He can go to page 349 and see what you did, basically. It's just, we're lining it up like this in this concrete order. You know, it could be structured anyway, any old way. But no, you author your life.
It's not written, we are.
You are, yeah. Mm-hmm.